This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Kristen Kowalski Farragut is with us, and I have been waiting for this. She is a storyteller. She is a poet. She's an essayist. She's a teacher. And now she's going to be a poet with an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. Waning when the moon is waxing. If only we fell like snowflakes, never crashing, never boring, not loud. We're only human, whirling in our individual little confoundations. We stuff a sock in it to muffle words, think of something else, turn away. We're not all good actors. Some of us have to not care to look like we don't care. I pray to the god of apathy every day. Using our passions against each other, we try to look sane with poor aim and lack of wherewithal, while we tamp down things intended for keeps, singing, chutzpah, ardor, the want to be heard in the rare conversation that matters. Just shovel it away, the sooted snow. Thank you.
That's Kristen. Now, tell us about that first poem. Isn't that really what poetry does? It sweeps away the soot. Don't you think that's a good way of describing what you do in life? Poetry takes away that dirty soot. Yes. And what do you think all the other poems say in this book? Here's Escape Velocity, beautiful cover. And tell us what is in this book and what do you think you did?
Okay. I wrote most of the poems in the book across a 3-year period where there was much going on in my life personally, as well as in the world. So I think I entered many of my poems as a way to understand what was happening with me and with my family and with the pandemic. So I used it as a point of introspection, as meditation, as therapy, if you will. But I think I came to the other side of the writing of the book, analyzing or looking at or holding up to light a lot of different troubling features of this world, but ultimately turning them around until you really see the beauty in all of the different angles of perspective.
And so doesn't that tell you something about yourself? That is so Kristen.
The glass is pretty full.
Oh, that is you. That is so you. Well, let's go on and read another one and then we'll tell you.
Okay. This one's entitled Transgendered X at Son's Birthday Party. I think to change into a t-shirt, something in which I can chase kids with water guns, something that disregards cleavage and shoulder. You arrive in a pretty little dress. It's edgy, a sweetheart neckline, white with black trim, and little crickets and bees perched about. And those legs, the sort I've always wanted, long and lean. Why do boys always have the best legs? No saddlebags or cellulite, but smooth exclamation points. Your legs point up beyond the flared skirt to your new chest that I don't recognize. I adjust my shirt, the one I will not change out of, the one that is not unisex. And I reapply my colored lip balm, the same as yours I gave you last winter. I give you a hug and you feel dewy, like a woman glistening. Never before good at forgetting, I cannot now remember what it was like to be yours. I hesitate when introducing myself as his mom with a glance towards you. I see your mascara as a challenge and think that I should accent my eyes more. More feminine and brave, I see you as a goddess, as supernatural as real. I wish I kept that man I met after you left, the one with the linear thoughts, who told me that women are from Venus and I talk too much, but only briefly, just to have someone to steady me for a moment. I avert my eyes as you bend to pick up a candle, a shock of electric blue peeking out. I imagine the men I might meet, Tom with the spiky beard that might rub a rash on my face when we kiss, Glenn who rides a motorcycle. You embraced your son and it looks like a parent holding birthday wishes to the boy. No change can render that image unforgettable. And for a moment again, I am yours.
You know, That's my favorite poem. And you know, everyone loves that poem for the enormous beauty and the courage of it. And you know, other people might just think such a thing, but you had to say it because that's what the poet does. Here's something interesting, though. The appearance on the page is different from any of your other poems. It's a little more ornate. It's a little more elegant and practiced. And it is very beautiful on the page. And I'm wondering if that was because it was really so hard to write. Was it hard to write?
I think it came together as three different poems I'd written. And I was sharing a personal anecdote with a friend and told her a story about Electric Blue Underwear. And she was like, there's a poem, write it. Mm. I wrote it and it wasn't very good. And then I wrote a couple of others that were similar themed.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then this all sort of came together from those. So this wasn't really one moment in time. This was a bunch of different moments. I moved things around and when it came out, I think it came out very prosaic. Like it was very much a story. And then I think I did a lot of editing in terms of form and appearance to sort of shape it into more of a poem.
There's nothing raw about this poem. You know what I think is the masterful part of it? Third stanza from the bottom. I wish I kept that man I met after you left. Inserting another experience, which really pivots the poem into harking into what could have been, and then going back to the situation. I thought that was a really skillful thing to do, to insert that. And I wish we could teach insertion more.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
That was excellent.
Workshops, I often get criticism for that. Because I think there's sort of a school of thought in poetry that a poem can only be about one thing. But I love bringing in, like, the one thing is my mind, right? And so I love bringing in pieces from lots of places.
That proved to me that you are a seasoned poet, because to have a situation and then to bring in the knot and the fan out again is what you did, which is it like expansion of energy creation, then compressing and expansion. So give us two in a row and we can see how you expand and compress. And I'll tell them who you are. And I know that you play the guitar. It's behind you. You sing and you perform. You do everything. You're fearless. You also host a wonderful reading series, which you'll talk about later. And then we know this is your first book, Escape Velocity. You have a children's book, Becoming the Enchantress. A magical transgender tale. Oh, you're going to be banned, honey. So banned in Florida.
I haven't gotten legs yet, but one day maybe.
Poetry has been in many, many periodicals. Beltway Quarterly, Bourgeon, Anti-Heroine Chic, Fledgling Rag, Little Patuxent Review, Gargoyle, and you have a blog we can all tune into. So let's hear two poems in a row so we really get enough of you.
Oh, thanks. All right, great. This one I actually wrote, I just got a message pop up on my Facebook page that this poem was written 3 years ago because I wrote it on a little mini retreat I took to a yurt in Virginia, and I was going to have a date. And this was a poem in anticipation of my date. But then that weekend, the world shut down and my daughter talked me out of dating. So all I have is a poem. It's called Underneath Quarantine. Because you could be anyone and I fall on a dime, let's bore into quarantine right through to the other side, outside and inside, out spaces. Let's walk between shadows of ghosts of crowds, shirking from the touch of points of ponytails and jacket cuffs, down aisles, between bookshelves, around dance floors and gazebos, above koi ponds. Because I don't really know you. You could be everyone. Let's share a kiss in memory of touch and communion. Let's play Russian roulette. Mm-hmm. I feel lucky. Bet we fall in the uninfected 30%. Because you have face and fingers, and those are remarkable things. It's already been so long and some truths hurt because still honesty. Let's quarantine together, spread all the good and danger that radiates and seeps. Let's meet. I'll buy the sake. We can share a glass.
Kristen Farragut.
And then changing tone a little bit, this one is called Life Care Planning. Emergency contact reads lonesome as a blown tire on a solo road trip, or the rise and fall of Feel Like Sugar on the Floor, crooned by Etta James Live. But there's nothing so romantic in a Kaiser examination room. Identify a healthcare agent, an alternate, and an alternate two, directs the workbook. The doctor wants you to fill us out. Nurse hands it over like a bouquet of hemlock. Names flit around the room. No one wants to sit on a line.
Let's play Russian roulette. I feel lucky. You know, what I get from your work is we can do this. We're all in this together. Just follow me. Just write that poem. We can get through this together. There's a great sense of poetry leadership in this. And also,
well, we sure have to try, right?
Not only try, but the poem is to succeed. And that's so great. Another thing, if I were to look at the tone of the whole book, it is, there is sweetness, there's a hipness, there's a compassion. And those are your three pillars, I think, of strength in the poetry. So let's hear one. And this time, after you read it, we would like to hear, or sometime before and sometime after, where you thought of the poem, when it occurred to you, how you started it, and why you chose what you said, the images. Just take it apart for us. So what is the poem?
Okay. This one is called Empathy. And I guess before I start, I'll introduce it by saying that I've been thinking of this concept for 30 years, dating myself. In my 20s, I really had a notion that empathy was a very dangerous thing. And I had very empathetic friends, and they related as saying that empathy was a dangerous thing. My kids have a hilarious, like, running joke they do about empaths. Like, I must be an empath. Somebody punched me in the face and it hurt. You know, it's like this funny joke about how, you know, people on TikTok or on YouTube do these videos of being very empathetic, but it's really just being, you know, being human and normal, right? But I do feel that there are some people that are very sensitive, and I mean, probably most of us, right? And it's good to sympathize with someone and care about them, try to understand them, try to be fair, try to be just. But I think I've always thought that it becomes pretty dangerous to try to be very empathetic, put yourself in their shoes, feel other people's pain. Because, you know, where does that put you? You have your own pain, and then you're feeling their pain. And then you're pressed with worry and sorrow and sadness. I just think it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. So this poem came up because it's kind of the gold standard in education now. I mean, that's kind of what I'm doing all day, is trying to teach kids to be empathetic. Well, I kind of don't want them to really feel anybody else's pain. I just want them to, like, deal with their own and, like, try to uplift them, right? So it's this funny, funny thing I'm walking. So here's a poem. Empathy. Do not go into the mire as though you might offer coattails to kite escape to fresh space. It's too hot for jackets, and besides, we set them aside long ago. We travel only with skin that fails to hold in heat from combustion hearts. There's no denying attraction to warmth, sound, dying to save another. The wail of a witch at the stake resonates the same as a banshee's warning. Both beguile, but only one might be saved. Loud-eyed do-gooders rebranded sympathy as pity, although she's the best understanding we had before throwing ourselves into the fire. All the green tea and dark leafy vegetables in the world won't protect us from our own good intentions.
You know, the green tea and the leafy vegetables really make the poem, because it's very hard to start with an idea. Don't you agree? I mean, that's a very profound idea, that we need to be aware of other people and compassion. But then when we become sponges, and you teaching special education, this is your mantra.
Yeah.
You have got to feel, but not feel everything.
Right. Right.
So did you write that because you were in just getting in touch with that?
No, I think I just had the idea, and it's just kind of ironic to me because I've had this idea for so long. It's just sort of part of my, mm-hmm. part of the way I approach life. And so it's ironic to me that now it really is the gold standard. We are teaching classes in empathy. We are teaching lessons on empathy. We want everybody to be empathetic. My take is that probably somebody who's naturally empathetic doesn't need a lesson. And somebody who's not empathetic, it might be hard to teach. I'm not sure. But I don't know why compassion and sympathy wouldn't stand in as helpful as empathy would.
Because so, the world is not, that is your mirror, but the world is not like you, Kristen. People, you say everyone is naturally kind and empathetic, but I have noticed that that isn't always true.
Right.
And so I do think children have to be taught kindness.
No, I do. I agree. And I think people naturally empathetic probably don't need to be taught it.
Right.
I do think that some people wouldn't naturally be that way, but then I'm not sure if empathy would be where I'd want to be directing them, or kindness, compassion, understanding, sympathy. I think there is a somewhat of a difference.
Well, here's what
it might just be semantics, but
because of who you are and whoever we are, we either demonstrate it or we don't. And that you can't persuade anyone to be anything, but what you are as a teacher is what they will, that will be rubbing off on them. So rub off on us some more. Read two in a row because okay. We love to hear it.
All right. Here we have, in the morning, I linger in thoughts of you. I rise late, your antics stuff every color you lent my world into a knapsack. You peel your stained glass heart from my window like an ocean wet handkerchief. I smell salt and sea spray. I wear rosary beads down to grains of sand, rub worry dolls until unraveled threads bejewel my hair. If love is an active noun like struggle, missing is like escape. I feel my heart pound, calling beyond hidden function. I pay phantom pain, no mind. See the true miracle that morning really does end. And then I'll read Celebration of Survival. This is a happy love poem. and in it, I reference Aion, which is the Greek god of time, but cyclical time. Celebration of Survival. Sometimes they converge to justify every prior moment, time, temperature. Above frozen lake in morning, see how it changes from solid to liquid, how sun spreads itself across slick, kisses your nose through wisps of smoke, cigarette dangling from your lips, how white caps of last night rest like glass. I brought only a small knapsack, but now I see I overpacked. See how my frozen hand warms in yours, how clothes peel off like days, while Aion erases years and asks, what would you trade for youth? Nothing, we agree.
Read that last line again.
Excellent. While Aion erases years and asks, what would you trade for youth? Nothing, we agree.
Stained glass heart.
Stained glass heart.
Stained glass heart. How did that ever come to you? Poets are such enigmas.
I have an enigma. We all are.
That's a beautiful. Now, I've never heard that before in my life. And I read poetry for 90 years. The stained glass heart, that will stay with me.
Oh, thanks.
Tell me what it's like to be a special education teacher. I taught in the lower grades, and there were enough stressors in an ideal situation. So tell me what you do all day, and if you bring your sweetness and your hipness and your compassion into the class.
Oh, that's so sweet. I love the way you asked that. I love my job. So special ed is such a wide range. I'd say maybe there's more diversity in the special ed community than there is in the general community. I mean, there's just such a range. So I've been in all sorts of different programs, all sorts of different age levels.
Always special ed. That's your specialty.
Yeah. Okay. I'm special.
And you're educated.
So right now I'm working with students that may have some intellectual challenges. No, sorry, may have some emotional challenges, or may have some maybe on the autism spectrum somewhere, but they're grade level or above. So these kids are wicked smart, but they're just gonna say what's on their mind and do what they're feeling. And I just love it so deeply. And it's a different, I don't know why I'm good. I like it. Like, I'm fine. Like, I can have a student saying a lot of words that we'd have to edit out. So I won't quote, but you know, I mean, really just using inappropriate language and it's just like, wow, you know, it's kind of entertaining. It just rolls off me. We just move on. And the way that sometimes the students perceive the world differently, or I teach history, so sometimes they have really great like insights or criticisms about, you know, American history or the world, and I'm always learning something. It's really
The fact that you love it so much, that is what we wish. We can't teach that in graduate school. We can't teach teachers to love. And by God, they are really so lucky. Well, and you love your job. How many people? I don't know many people that say that, actually. And the most difficult job of all, to understand from another person's point of view, even if it's a little different from the general point of view.
Right.
And another thing that takes up your time is being a curator of poets in a performative setting. So tell everyone what you do.
Sure. So I took over the diverse Gaithersburg reading series from Lucinda Marshall, started it maybe 5-6 years ago. And so she wanted to spend her time doing some other things. So I took it over. We're partnering with Casey Community Center in Gaithersburg, and they're lovely. So we have this beautiful space where we meet the first Thursday of every month. Mm. We have typically two featured readers, though sometimes we may host a group of poets from an anthology. But typically it's two featured readers and then an open mic. And there are just so many magical things about this. It's a little bit of work. I sometimes get stressed out the first Thursday of the month because it makes a really long day for me, but I'm almost always jazzed afterwards. Of course, on Friday and breakfast, I can't sleep because I'm so excited because of poetry. Like, last Thursday was so good. But the other thing about it that kind of amazes me, I'm not sure if Casey Center knew it, but they have this amazing community of really great poets right in-house. So we have 4 or 5 people who actually work at Casey who come into the open mic and read and blow me away. And that's just so cool, you know? So it's, you know, our community met their community, and it's just bigger and better now.
Well,
so
if everyone's getting a notion of your electricity, that's what it's like to the max in that room. And the open mic is truly amazing. I mean, I heard such original, fresh work. It was a unique experience. But to be a presenter does take, people don't understand the prep it takes, the scheduling, the conversations to prepare the poet, then to stand up there and to orchestrate it. So, and yet the presenter must always be writing poetry. It's a double whammy for sure. But we like to live on the edge, right?
We do.
We like the double whammy. And let us have a final poem.
Excellent. All right. This one is called To Dally in Fibonacci Spirals. Join me to whisk away judgment and chores, fugitives from space and time. Don't you know we can open them both? Like sweet pineapples, malleable cauliflower, we too make delicious treats from being hardy and rough. Mind your tender shoulder, but still throw worry to the stars and sling that guitar onto your back. Let's flee from lines to dance in spirals, pass our past, run to the old swing set by the abandoned barn to fly above the hurricane. Come to me in your empty hours. We'll bring restlessness to a boil until it evaporates off to sleep. slip ourselves into space between, like chicory petals, pine cone scales, waves.
Bring restlessness to a boil. That is the voice of Kristen Kowalski-Farragut. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipid Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.